From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. On today's programme, the votes are counted, but what do the results mean? We'll look at last night's events in New York, New Jersey and Virginia. Also today, the UN Humanitarian Affairs Chief Valerie Amos tells us the Syrian refugee crisis is intensifying.
This is having an impact on generations of Syria's children.
Black Panther William Potts is back on US soil after 29 years in Cuba. How will the justice system deal with him? Human rights organizations decry Bangladeshi justice for handing down 150 death sentences in one day. And found in Germany a trove of art not seen since the Holocaust.
The difficult thing now is to make certain that they are married up with all their owners.
That's ahead on FSN Reports after our summary of the day's main stories.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Both Republicans and Democrats can claim key victories in local elections across the United States, including the governor's races in New Jersey and Virginia. The results are being seen as an indication of where the political winds are blowing in the U.S. From Washington, Priscilla Huff has more.
Democrats cheered the election of Terry McAuliffe to be the next governor of Virginia.
Well, there are a lot of proud Democrats here, and aren't we proud tonight, folks?
Republicans cheered the re-election of Chris Christie as governor of New Jersey.
Thank you, New Jersey, for making me the luckiest guy in the world.
With pundits quickly noting, Governor Christie is sounding more and more like a candidate to run for the White House in 2016. Analysts are digging deep into the election data, noting the Virginia governor's race highlights a major problem for the Republicans. Women under the age of 40 generally won't vote for them, and the Tea Party is struggling to attract voters. But that does not mean smooth sailing for the Democrats either. With the failed launch of President Obama's health care insurance program hanging over the party and questions of whether lawmakers of both parties can work together to get anything done.
One of the most notable races was held in the Big Apple. Democrat Bill de Blasio has been elected as the new mayor of New York City. He'll take over from Republican Michael Bloomberg to become one of the most high-profile figures in American politics. Nick Harper reports from New York.
After 12 years of Michael Bloomberg, there's now a new mayor running the city.
The people of this city have chosen a progressive path.
Acknowledging his landslide victory, Bill de Blasio said there was much work to be done.
Tackling inequality isn't easy. It never has been and it never will be. The challenges we face have been decades in the making.
De Blasio's campaign railed against income inequality, promising to tax wealthier residents and end controversial police practices. Despite New York being a liberal-leaning, largely Democrat city, it hasn't had a Democrat mayor for more than 20 years. De Blasio changes that and is promising big changes in the Big Apple.
In other news, Britain's Home Office has compiled a list of around 100 VIP overseas business executives who will be given special treatment to help speed up their visa applications. Our UK correspondent Natalie Powell has more.
The British government has been quick to say that those in the Great Club will undergo the same checks as all other travellers, but its plan to attract highly skilled and high-value business executives has created a list of 100 strong VIPs known as the Great Club, and those on the list will be given their own visa account manager and personalised assistance to ensure that immigration checks are swift and smooth.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. An American man who hijacked a plane to Cuba has returned to the United States. William Potts has spent the past 30 years in Cuba, 13 of which were spent behind bars for his crime. U.S. authorities took Potts into custody after he landed in the U.S., but Potts says he's already done the time for his actions. Lawmakers and law enforcement are discussing security measures that would prevent another tragedy like the deadly shooting at the Los Angeles International Airport. But increased security could pose problems for passengers. Lindsay Mastis reports from Los Angeles.
The Los Angeles police chief says law enforcement cannot handle the type of increased security that would have prevented the shooting at LAX last Friday. Chief Charlie Beck says the airport would need military-like checkpoints where every car is stopped and searched before entering airport property. He says it would take passengers days to get into LAX with that level of security. The union representing the Transportation Security Administration wants its agents armed, a proposal opposed by Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid.
And Russia is getting ready to send the Olympic torch to space for the first time in history. On Thursday, the Winter Olympics Committee will be sent to the International Space Station on board a Russian space vehicle. From Moscow, Tom Barton reports.
The Olympic torch will travel into Earth's orbit with the next space station crew. Russia's Mikhail Turin, NASA's Rick Mastracchio, and Koichi Wakata of Japan. The astronauts will carry the unlit torch around the space station before taking it out on a spacewalk. In 1996, the Olympic torch was carried aboard the US space shuttle Atlantis for the Atlanta Summer Olympics. However, it will be the first time the torch will be taken outside a spacecraft. That same torch will then be used to light the Olympic flame in Sochi in February 2014 at the opening of the Winter Olympic Games.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports.
The only greatest honor and privilege than being a one-term governor of New Jersey is to be a two-term governor of New Jersey.
Governor Chris Christie celebrating his re-election in New Jersey last night, a result that rekindled the discussion about whether he might seek the Republican presidential nomination in 2016. Tuesday night's races shook up governor's mansions, city halls and local policies across the country. Democrat Terry McAuliffe, a man with extensive ties to Bill and Hillary Clinton, narrowly triumphed in the Virginia gubernatorial race. And Bill de Blasio, the next mayor of New York, says he'll pursue fairer, more progressive policies than the man he's succeeding, Michael Bloomberg. The results also saw the first East Coast city to legalize marijuana possession and votes in favor of raising local minimum wages in New Jersey and Seattle. With a look at the results and what they mean, FSN's Alice Alstein.
Taking the stage in Asbury Park, New Jersey, Tuesday night to deliver a victory speech, Republican Governor Chris Christie said his record of bipartisanship and getting work done helped him win re-election.
We stand here tonight showing that it is possible to put doing your job first.
Christie famously worked with President Obama on helping his state recover and rebuild after the extensive damage from Hurricane Sandy. And on Tuesday, he did win the votes of many Democrats, women, and people of color in his state. With rampant speculation that he may run for president in 2016, Christie used his speech last night to chide Congress for its current partisan gridlock.
Now listen, I know that if we can do this in Trenton, New Jersey, maybe the folks in Washington, D.C. should tune in their TVs right now.
But Christie's record as governor doesn't exactly reflect these reaching-across-the-aisle values. 3 years in a row, Christie vetoed an income tax increase for the state's wealthiest citizens and instead insisted on deep cuts to education, family planning, and other public programs. Earlier this year, he also vetoed an increase in the state's minimum wage, but voters overrode that decision last night by an even larger margin than his re-election. New Jersey's minimum wage will now increase by a full dollar to $8.25 an hour, and will automatically increase with inflation in the future. On the other side of the country, the town of SeaTac in Washington State also voted to raise its minimum wage to a national record of $15 an hour. But a popular statewide ballot initiative to mandate labeling of genetically modified foods met defeat. David Cobb with the political watchdog organization Move to Amend credits the flood of largely corporate and out-of-state money for this outcome.
Who are the largest contributors? Monsanto Corporation, DuPont Corporation, the Grocery Manufacturers Association, which is made up of the mega corporate retail chains. What we're seeing in Washington State is what we saw in California, and that is huge amounts of corporate money pouring in to completely pervert the election process.
Big out-of-state spending also had a major role in the Virginia governor's race, in which former Clinton fundraiser and DNC chair Terry McAuliffe outspent and edged out Tea Party favorite and state attorney general Ken Cuccinelli. Energy, media, and finance executives gave McAuliffe millions of dollars. But progressive social groups, including Planned Parenthood and the Climate Action Committee, made a difference as well, funding ads about Cuccinelli's record, denying climate change, and opposing women's reproductive rights. Progressive groups are also celebrating the victory of New York City's first Democratic mayor in 20 years, Bill de Blasio.
Tackling inequality isn't easy. It never has been and it never will be. The challenges we face have been decades in the making. And the problems we set out to address will not be solved overnight.
New York City activists with the Center for Constitutional Rights and other groups are already rallying to hold de Blasio to one of his major campaign stances, opposition to the NYPD's controversial stop and frisk policy that has largely targeted young New Yorkers of color. They're gathering on the steps of City Hall today to demand de Blasio drop the city's appeal of the court ruling against stop and frisk. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
And so to Washington's favorite parlor game. What, if anything, do these results presage for the midterm elections next November and the presidential elections 2 years after that? A little earlier, I spoke with Amy Walter, national editor of the Cook Political Report.
The overall takeaway is that candidates actually matter. In Virginia and in New Jersey, a candidate who campaigned more as a moderate and a pragmatist was able to win, whereas in a place like Alabama, a more moderate candidate was successful there as well.
When Chris Christie, and we heard him there, says to people, I hope everybody in Washington is paying attention to this. I mean, he's clearly suggesting that despite the difficulties he's had with other Republicans, he could be a runner for the future. Does he have any right to imagine that that's possible?
He absolutely does. I mean, what he did in New Jersey last night was to show Republicans and Democrats that a candidate who is conservative can win in a blue state, in part by winning over the kinds of voters that Republicans have been unable to win, voters like Latinos, like women. But he's done it without having to sacrifice his conservative bona fides.
And what does Terry McAuliffe do for Hillary Clinton, if anything?
If I'm Hillary Clinton, I think that I still would want to be keeping as far away from traditional politics and politicians as I get closer to 2016. Her challenge right now is to look as much like a new outsider figure. She can never completely distance herself from her past and from the fact that she's been involved in American politics now for 20 plus years. But I think the less she reminds Americans of that, the better for her.
The morning after the night before thoughts of Amy Walter, national editor of the Cook Political Report. You're with FSN Reports. In Syria, the United Nations says the number of people needing urgent aid has ballooned. That comes as hopes for future peace talks appear to have stalled, despite progress on the international mission to destroy Syria's stockpile of chemical weapons. FSN's UN correspondent Stephen Fee spoke with the organization's top humanitarian affairs official, Valerie Amos. And she says the crisis for bystanders in the 2.5-year civil war is intensifying.
We're now talking about 9.3 million people in the country who are severely affected by this crisis. That's more than 40% of the population. It's had a huge impact, the violence, the brutality, but also things like people running out of food because they've not been able to, for example, go to either their farms or because food has not been able to come to them. Fuel supplies are now very scarce. Water, electricity, all of this has been affected. The health systems in the country, it's having a huge impact. And of course, the issues in terms of the way that the children have been traumatized, this is having an impact on generations of Syria's children. And then, of course, you've had over 2 million people who have fled the country and registered as refugees. So the situation is very bad on the ground.
Some of the hurdles that you're talking about seem bureaucratic. And I want to know, in your conversations with either the Syrian government or opposition leaders or even regional leaders in Syria, what are they telling you about these bureaucratic hurdles? Why can't they be overcome and faster?
Well, of course, a lot of these hurdles have been put in place by the government in terms of visas, clearances, you know, how many NGOs can operate in the country, how many international NGOs can operate in the country. So we are having ongoing discussions with the government in relation to those. The government constantly tells us that they want to be helpful. And we have managed to get, for example, in terms of visas, we got quite a lot of them cleared, but we still have a number outstanding, which is causing some challenges for us.
Let's talk about what members should be doing or could be doing from the Security Council. Where do you think they can be applying the most pressure?
Well, of course, the biggest influence that they could have is on the political agenda and actually getting some kind of agreement to some kind of political solution. I mean, people, ordinary people caught up in violence, can't be besieged in this way, should not be besieged in this way. So they need to use their influence to do that, to say to the opposition and to say to the government, this is completely unacceptable. It's against all international humanitarian law and all the principles that are important in terms of human rights and also human rights law. That's the first thing. So let's get the aid in. Secondly, the security situation on the ground. It is really important that all the emblems, that what we do as humanitarian work is respected and protected.
The UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, Valerie Amos, speaking there to FSN's Stephen Fee. Now to the case of William Potts. 29 years after he hijacked an American passenger plane to Cuba, the Black Panther Movement member is back on American soil. He had hoped Cuba would welcome him with open arms. Instead, his actions landed him 13 years behind bars. He is still wanted in the US over air piracy charges, and he flew into Miami Airport a few hours ago. FSN's Lorna Shaddock spoke to Philip Brenner, Professor of International Relations at American University in Washington.
Well, William Potts was a member of the Black Panther Party in the 1980s. He was a young man, and in a kind of idealistic rage, he hijacked an airplane and demanded that it be flown to Cuba. And his goal was to learn how to better overthrow the United States government. He thought he could get trained in Cuba to do this. And he, when he arrived in Cuba, he was imprisoned, and he spent 13 years in a Cuban prison. This is a man who is wants to be able to see his children, who are now living in Georgia. He can't do so unless he has essentially cleared himself from the justice authorities in the United States, because he's a wanted criminal for hijacking, air piracy. And so he has to clear himself so that he can regularly travel between Cuba and the United States. He says he wants to go back and live in Cuba. And this is one guy who committed a crime, served some time in prison, may serve some more time in prison. And it's good that Cuba and the United States could agree and talk about these kinds of things. There are other cases where they can't talk about these things. The more we talk, the more likely we'll understand each other better.
And one reason I think that people are so interested in this, despite perhaps, as you say, it not being terribly significant, is they're interested in what kind of reception Mr. Potts will get from the U.S. authorities. But what sort of reception do you think he'll get?
It's hard to imagine he'll get a friendly reception. Unless he were willing to somehow denounce Cuba and talk about being tortured in a Cuban prison, which there's no evidence that he was, and it's not clear he would denounce Cuba since he wants to go back and live there, I think U.S. authorities are likely to put him in prison. And he's asking for clemency. He's already served 13 years, and a normal prison term supposedly is something like 20 years. He has renounced violence and renounced any attempt to overthrow the United States government. But it's hard to imagine that a U.S. court would completely exonerate him and essentially not force him to serve more prison time.
Professor Philip Brenner of American University on the case of William Potts. Now, human rights groups have condemned a Bangladeshi court responsible for handing the death sentence down to 152 soldiers over a mutiny in 2009. The two-day border guard revolt over pay and conditions left 74 people dead, most of them officers. Thousands of troops had already been sentenced by an army court, but additional civilian trials can carry the death penalty. Party. My colleague Kevin McAlee spoke to Tej Tapa, senior researcher for Human Rights Watch, who has been following the story since the mutiny occurred.
The mutiny led to 74 deaths, many more injured. The government had been newly elected at that point, Sheikh Hasina's government, and because Bangladesh has a history of military coups, there was a lot of anxiety surrounding the mutiny, with the new government fearing that it was an attempt by the military to again take control. Sheikh Hasina, at that point, and her government, they stood up to the army. They refused to allow a military intervention, and they negotiated a political settlement, which was the correct course to take. Following that, however, and in part, I think, to keep the military happy, the government prosecuted 6,000 soldiers of the Bangladesh Rifles, 823 of whom are presently are the subjects of this present verdict, in which 152 have been sentenced to death. An additional 161, I believe, have been sentenced to life.
Is this a precedent in terms of the number of defendants being handed the death penalty in a single court proceeding?
In recent history, to the best of our knowledge, and I've asked around extensively about this, this does seem to be easily the largest number of death sentences handed down. There have been mass trials. Italy has conducted mass trials of mafia members, for instance, but not facing the death penalty. So yes, this would be, as far as we're aware, a precedent.
And what about the opportunity for appeal here?
Well, one can only hope that. I mean, there is certainly under the law provision for appeal. One of the central problems that we've highlighted is that a lot of these defendants have not had lawyers. They are not represented. They're not aware of the charges against them. They're not aware of the evidence against them. So that's a central problem. They are, of course, entitled to lawyers by Bangladeshi law, but a lot of them have told me in person that they don't trust the state-appointed counsel. In theory, yes, they can appeal. And convictions can either be overturned or reduced, but there are all kinds of practical constraints.
Tej Tapa from Human Rights Watch. Now to Germany, where a secret collection of 1,400 artworks taken by the Nazis during the Second World War has been unearthed. They were hidden in the Munich apartment of Cornelius Gurlitt, whose father Hildebrand had acquired them in the 1930s and 40s. The collection spans the 1600s to the 20th century and includes works by Matisse, Picasso, Chagall, Renoir and Toulouse-Lautrec. We're now learning that the German authorities found the trove in early 2012. FSN's Daniel Wrenches has been speaking with Julian Radcliffe, chairman of the Art Loss Register, which runs an international database of stolen and lost works.
It is an important collection, although we have not yet seen all the pictures, and some of them are pictures the existence of which we didn't know about because they were painted by the artist and never catalogued prior to their being looted. So they are important, and the difficult thing now is to make certain that they are married up with all their owners, some of whom may sadly not exist since there may be no heirs to the original people who were from whom they were looted.
The history itself, obviously, it comes from a very troubling time. Does that impact the way in which people then regard the art that has been unearthed?
Yes, and it also has a very important effect. Even if there is a law which technically says it's difficult after 30 years to claim a picture which has been stolen, a statute of limitation, any picture which has been the subject of looting, particularly from the Holocaust era, is unsaleable because nobody will ever want to buy it once they know its history.
But if they were returned, for example, to an original family...
They lose the taint. Once it's known that there's been a settlement with the family, then the pictures are free to be sold. And indeed, one picture was taken into a auction house in Germany. The auction house realized that the picture had a history to it and did a settlement with the family. This is a picture called the Lahntamer. And that picture was sold for 750,000 euros, which was quite a good price.
Were any of these works that have been unearthed, to your knowledge, also have been onto your list of stolen works? Yes. or is this a complete surprise?
No, some of these pictures will be on our database, having been recorded with us by victims. The reason that the Germans have not, I think, publicised all of these pictures and may not do so for some time is that they don't want to attract a lot of bogus claims.
That would explain, would it, why there's been an apparent sort of delay in the German authorities revealing the information that they've had for some time about this.
Yes, but I think there may be an additional reason, which is that they were undertaking a fiscal investigation, but it may have been wider than that. I would think that they would want to have looked at a lot of his transactions, would not want to alert other people to the fact they were doing that. His name may have been on the list of German citizens who had Swiss bank accounts, that list being provided by informers in Switzerland to the German intelligence service. That may be the reason why he was picked up originally in what they described as a random customs check.
Julian Radcliffe of the Art Loss Register talking to FSN's Daniel Wrenches. In Britain, a task force has been put together in a bid to try and catch a terror suspect who escaped from Minders by wearing a burqa. Several security agencies have joined forces to find Mohammed Ahmed Mohammed, who is alleged to have close links to the Somali insurgent group Al-Shabaab. From FSN's London Bureau, Ollie Barrett reports.
Counter-Terrorism Command at the Metropolitan Police, Security Service MI5 and the UK Border Agency now cooperating under a joint task force to try and locate Mohammed Ahmed Mohammed. He absconded from a mosque in West London last week, entering in full view in his own clothes, leaving dressed in a burqa. Home Secretary Theresa May says everything is being done to try and find him.
The police and security service have confirmed that they do not believe that this man poses a direct threat to the public in the UK. The reason he was put on a TPIM in the first place was to prevent his travel to support terrorism overseas.
A TPIM is a terrorism prevention and investigation measure which involves monitoring of suspects officials decide are dangerous but can't legally be charged or deported. They replaced a system brought in by the previous government called control orders, perceived as tougher than TPIMs by the Prime Minister's critics in the House of Commons.
Two suspects have used their government-granted freedom to escape. The latest one clad in a burqa. Will the Prime Minister admit that this decision was a hugely irresponsible mistake?
But Prime Minister David Cameron is unrepentant while insisting it is a difficult balance.
We should be frank in this House that what we're dealing with is people that we are not able to charge and lock up, and people that many of whom we'd like to throw out of our country but cannot currently, and so we have to have some sort of regime like this.
27-year-old Mohammed Ahmed Mohammed is believed to have fought in support of the Al-Shabaab militant group on the front line in Somalia. He is not the first Briton to have done so, leading to much questioning of what leads a young person from the UK towards the Somali insurgents. Dr. Laura Hammond is an Al-Shabaab expert at SOAS, University of London.
It tends to be people who are marginalised by society, who may not have a mentor or father figure or a strong family support network. They tend to be kind of drifting, and those would-be recruiters kind of prey upon those people, offer them in the first instance just a kind of community to be part of, and then gradually, it's a series of steps, but gradually they become more and more radicalized such that they join the movement.
Mohammed Ahmed Mohammed, though, remains on the run, having given his Minders the slip in what is an embarrassing episode for UK security services. Ollie Barrett, London.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the programme by sending us an email. Our address is reports@featurestory.com. And you can also follow us on Twitter. We are there at Feature Story. I'm Simon Marks in Washington, alongside producer Kevin McAleese and Rebecca Foster at the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.